Welcome to the MindBod Adventure Pod, where every week we dive into a different practice, a different perspective on life, and you come along to try it with us. Join us on Substack at mindbodpod.com to watch this episode as a video podcast. And if you want to support our crazy adventures and get fun perks like our weekly after party videos, consider becoming a paid subscriber. And now, on to this week's adventure.
Casper Terkyle, welcome to the Consciousness Explorers podcast. We are very happy to have you here.
Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be with you.
So I devoured your book, The Art of Ritual, and I thought that could be a place to begin. Of course, I know all about you, but maybe share for our listeners who you are, I guess your view on practice, which you frame as ritual, and maybe we could talk about that difference, and then a little bit about what ritual or practice we're going to explore together.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I always imagine the chapter heading to my story so far is like gay atheist goes to divinity school. I grew up in England in a, secular household. I didn't go to church. Religion wasn't part of my parents or grandparents or friends' lives. Really was pretty, not part of our growing up. And suddenly as a gay kid, religion was either irrelevant or cruel. So I had no desire for it. But I got very involved in climate change activism as a young adult and ended up trying to mobilize young people around the UN climate negotiations. And like so many 21-year-olds, felt like the whole world's future rested on my shoulders. And, when Obama and the Chinese government and the EU didn't get to any sort of meaningful agreement in 2009, I thought it was all my fault. And so I ended up in, I think, a pretty classic case of activist burnout. And What struck me in those months of, just real despair, kind of losing hope and a sense of that what I'd been doing was meaningful, I noticed that the leaders I respected most in social change movements nearly always had something spiritual going on, right? Like they were a Quaker or they had a meditation practice or there was something going on that to me had always been a little weird and mysterious. And I found myself drawn to it. And I came to graduate school to study public policy where, you ask questions like, how do you reduce recidivism? And it's kind of very technical approach to, really important big questions. But I kept meeting people from the divinity school who were asking, why do we have prisons? Which is a very different kind of conversation. Yeah. And I immediately felt myself drawn there, but assumed that divinity school is just for Catholic priests. Like I had no idea what that was or if it could be for me. And it was just an absolute joy to discover that, yes, my instincts for bringing people together and meaning making and singing together and eating together and trying to remember what matters most in our everyday life, that these are not just kind of interesting side questions, but like the very heart of what religious life and practice is all about. And so found myself like obsessed with religion, even though I didn't quite fit into a particular category. And so the last decade of my life since moving to the US has really been thinking about, well, knowing that more and more people are like me in that either you're not religious or you never even were born into something, what is the kind of spiritual infrastructure of the future going to look like in a post-congregational world? So, as more and more people don't fit into those traditional boundaries of belonging, and more than half the American population now doesn't belong to a congregation, what is spiritual life going to look like for people like us? And so my work has been part research and studying in academic and popular contexts, some writing and teaching through books and things. And then also as a practitioner, someone who's trying to figure that out in real time, both in my own life, but also trying to create projects and organizations that speak to some of those needs. So that's me.
What an awesome journey.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I can relate so hard. I find that like a lot of people that we have on the show and people that are friends of us have that similar thing. Like you started in something completely unrelated to any kind of religious tradition. You were just trying to do good. And then you're kind of like, where does this fit? How do I make sense of all this? And then you kind of creep in the back door of some kind of spiritual practice.
Totally. Well, and I think especially because religion or healthy, I should say healthy spirituality and healthy religion is one of the few places where it's okay for things to not make sense or for things to have failed or, suffering is not strange. It's pretty much at the heart of what most of these traditions are about. And I think that's so unusual in our kind of hyper technical capitalist world of, you know, to find a refuge like that is like finding water in the desert, because it means I'm not crazy or I'm not bad, you know.
Absolutely.
And that was certainly my experience.
Well, the one of the things I loved about your book was it's sort of the organizing principle is the ritual, the things that we do to help us connect and sustain ourselves and help us feel connected to something larger. And what you did that was so innovative that I love is that you basically said, you know what, we're already doing this, that there are all kinds of communities of practice. They may not call themselves quite that, but that effectively have a shared ritual that supports people in all these different ways. Let me show you how these are already here. So then you can use that as a kind of existential highlighter under your life to augment the signal on what's already here for you. So could you say a little bit about that piece?
I love that idea of an existential highlighter. I want one of those in my back pocket. Jeff, you're absolutely right. You know, one of the key things that I took away from my studies was that in the West, especially in the kind of Christian cultural context, when we say the word religion, we think about belief, right? Do you accept Jesus as your Lord and Savior, right? Like that's the kind of test that in some way is imprinted in our brain. And it's not to say that belief is irrelevant, but if you look at a broader swath of religious history and religious traditions, what's much more important is what do you practice? What do you do? Do you honor the ancestors? Do you observe the new moon? Do you keep the Sabbath? Do you keep kosher? You know, whatever it is. There's so much more about what you do than what you believe. And when you start thinking about religion through that frame of practice, as you said, you start to see it everywhere. And so this was part of the study that my colleague Angie Thurston and I did called How We Gather, where we looked at secular organizations from, you know, fitness groups like CrossFit and SoulCycle to justice movements, to creative groups and maker spaces, and what, you know, workplace wellness programs. So all sorts of things that were ostensibly totally secular. But when you looked at what was happening there and you looked at the practices, it looked very religious very quickly, right? People getting married and having funerals in their CrossFit box.
Wow.
People preaching and like raising money for someone else's breast cancer in a SoulCycle class. People celebrating Thanksgiving and advocating around homelessness issues in a makerspace. Right? All of these things that you would expect to see in a congregation, looking after each other's dog if someone's going on vacation, you know, the weekly potluck, all of this kind of stuff that looks like any church basement was suddenly happening in these secular spaces. And so rather than telling a story of, oh, we are in a time of religious decline, what I try and argue is that we're in a time of religious transformation.
No question.
And the same practices are still happening, but they look different and they're happening in different places. And even the people who are leading them don't necessarily describe them as spiritual or religious. Although that changes as they keep going, because
of
one of the things we found is as we interviewed these leaders, you know, a friend who set up an organization supporting people who've experienced grief at a young age in their 20s and 30s. You know, at first she was creating a nonprofit. But very quickly, she was like, oh, I am dealing with something much bigger than just fundraising and program management. I'm tending to people's souls. And that is asking more of me as a leader. And I have not had that training.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about learning from religious traditions is that, you know, whether it's in the sacred texts or whether in the wisdom practices of a community, there's a lot that religion has learned about how we should be together and what leadership does in terms of isolation and the dangers of being responsible for a community, right? And if you're just there running a nonprofit and suddenly you're counseling someone through a divorce or you're helping someone navigate a diagnosis, right? You're being asked to do things that as a CrossFit trainer, you were not prepared for.
Absolutely.
Well, so suddenly you're describing my life, basically.
I just made me think of the very first job I ever had coming out of university. I went to school for developmental psychology, and I'm a music producer.
Beautiful.
So the first job I ever got was running this community program for at-risk youth, teaching them music production. They're like, you know about working with youth. You are a youth. You work on music. Here's $300,000. Build a studio. Run it. And then, like, 2 weeks into the program, I'm like 40, you know, young kids. Well, they're only like 2-3 years younger than me. And they're having this debate about like queerness and like, you know, some of them are like, it's against God. It's horrible. Other ones who I'm like, I'm pretty sure this kid is going to come out later this like season. And he's like, you know, like they're having these existential arguments. And I'm like, I do not have the training. I don't have support for this. And then like the week later, I'm showing them all how to put condoms on a banana to make sure they're not yes. having, you know, it's like you sign up for these like kind of concrete roles and then you find yourself as a space holder for people. And whatever comes up, you're like, I hope I can do this.
just to underline that, that was exactly my experience with the, when I started the Consciousness Explorers Club, which was a nonprofit back in the day. It was a place we would just, it was exploratory. We would meditate and out of the woodwork people came, but a lot of people with mental health challenges. And all of a sudden, and I wasn't building myself even back then at the beginning as a meditation teacher. I was just a community organizer, you know, and it, very quickly I realized I was out of my depth and I had to do a lot of, training and boundary setting and learning that it's still ongoing, but it's become a kind of specialty now because I've worked with so many neurodivergent kinds of folks and challenges that I do know more about it. But it's exactly as you say, you don't know what you're going to get into because people want, you know, it's their whole lives people bring to this. And when you're talking about practice and that kind of a context, that the whole life comes and therefore the whole, all the parts of you that need support that are out of whatever it is. So,
It's like the things that you put in the calendar have boundaries, you know, it's like 6 p.m. come and cycle with us. But the person coming, their life is unbounded. They're like, blah, here it is, you know, and a good, and for good reason because we're all looking for healing from something, you know.
100%. And I think one of the key kind of analytical tools that's been helpful for me to understand in this moment of like institutional decline is that, you know, maybe 200 years ago, you're a Polish immigrant to America, you're Catholic, you go to your Polish Catholic parish and you find not just weekly worship, but pastoral care, job opportunities, you know, ways to be fed like physically. And then later, you know, maybe you will be giving back to the community.
Yeah.
There was one institution that really fulfilled a lot of those functions. And now as that has winnowed or completely disappeared, we still have those needs, right? But where are we going to take them? And Instagram double taps, like, do not a community make. And so if there's a place where there's someone who's trusted, like you were, Tasha, or like you are, Jeff, in those circles, people are going to show up with everything that they've got going on. And there's questions about, you know, people navigating boundaries and all of that kind of stuff as participants. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't fault them because, like, where else are you going to go?
Have,
and so when you find someone you trust, right? Like, no wonder.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate you both getting that at a very, like, deep level because that's a very, very strong pattern that we've seen over and over again.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, let's maybe just, there's the kind of community piece and the practices and the rituals we do together. And there's also stuff you talk about that we can do on our own. And I wanted to, before we get into your example of a practice, or a ritual. I mean, maybe we should just distinguish what it is we're talking about here. What is a ritual? And what are the ingredients? You know, if people are looking around their own life to say, oh, actually, that's true. Maybe I do have this going on. Like, what is it they should be looking for? What are the ingredients of a ritual that is genuinely supportive? I know there must be a lot of variation, but I imagine there are some core principles. So,
And you're so right that language can get a little fuzzy here. So I usually try and differentiate the word habit from the word ritual, because there are many, many things that we do habitually, and most of them serve a functional purpose, right? Like I brush my teeth in the morning and at night, and I do that because I care about good oral hygiene. that's a habit, right?
You're going to get enlightened. Oh, my God.
Hey, whoa.
Why not?
Road to mysticism right there, mystic in action.
The way I differentiate like a ritual from a habit is that there's an additional layer of meaning on top of the functional purpose. So I like to, you know, another simple morning routine example. When I put moisturizer on my face in the morning, that would be a habit, but I add a little element to it that turns it into a ritual, which is as I'm putting the cream like on my face, massaging it into my, you know, into my skin, I will say, life is full of joy and suffering, and today will be no different. And it's beautiful. Just a little reminder to be like, yeah, there's going to be good things, going to be bad things. That's what life is all about. And so I try and find a way to bring an intention to the practice, right? That's what I want to remember. It's going to be joy, it's going to be suffering. I pay attention while I'm doing it, which is literally like the lovely smell. I can't even remember what the particular primrose smell is or whatever of the moisturizer I'm using. But it's a very tactile practice, right? I'm like literally touching my own face. And then I'm repeating that each day. So that kind of triptych of intention, attention, and repetition is how I think about kind of taking a daily habit and turning it into a ritual. But it doesn't have to be daily. I'm someone who really struggles with daily practice. I admire enormously people who have like a stringent meditation practice that's every morning or every evening. I suck at it. So I really look for things that I can do on a weekly level or a monthly level. So thinking about, you know, thinking about the calendar year, thinking about weekly rhythms like a Sabbath where you kind of take time away from work and the tools of work. Thinking about particular cycles in the month. You know, I host tonight. Actually, I'll be hosting my monthly singing circle where I get like 15 friends over and we just sing songs for like 3 hours. Mm. So those are the practices for me that have become kind of rituals, just in that sense of having that level of intention, the focus of attention while I'm practicing them, and then the repetition over time.
That's so good. Intention, attention, repetition. Remember that,
IR,
folks.
IR.
Yeah.
oh, I like that little acronym.
I like to make acronyms out of everything. E-R.
Okay. Well, just because I don't get a chance to nerd out about this, I know we're going to go into practice. I just thought I'd try to draw you out slightly on this. When I think about this question of what goes into practice, because it's kind of the one that I'm more obsessed with than anything else, I also think of it in terms of, well, what are the inside things that we do? Because as a meditator, there's things I notice in my experience, ways I can kind of shift how my mind and body are, that to me are really at the core of my meditation practice, and they're at the core of the other things that I do. And for me, I think of it as, first of all, how you commit your attention. So that's the kind of, that's the concentration piece or the selection piece. You choose what you're going to commit your attention to, and you may choose it again and again. And the more longer you commit to it, the more you kind of get absorbed and into flow with it. So there's there's this potential for being absorbed in this very nice way. There is often a skill of clarity, a skill of awareness. Like, what am I noticing? Like, I'm awake for this. I'm noticing the details. I'm noticing what gets in the way in myself that's preventing this. So there's like a sense in which awareness is expanding to notice more subtle variables. And then there's the care piece, the heart we bring to it, the, whether it's compassion or care or gratitude. And of course, that basic training of this part of being human. And then for me, there's the super juice in all of that, which is really the equanimity, which is the allowing, the not pushing and pulling on the moment, the opening to exactly what's here and being available to it. It's the kind of humility that receives the medicine. It's the it's what leads to a capacity to be vulnerable, to share what's here. And when I look at practices and rituals in any tradition, any context, I'm just seeing those four skills again, again, and other things as well. But I find that just, like, I can't even describe how exciting and thrilling and beautiful I find that, because it helps people then, once they understand those skills, they can recombine them in any, every kind of way. And they can, so they can find a journaling practice that works for them or a community CrossFit. I mean, you can have as deep a spiritual experience in CrossFit as you can anywhere if you have enough equanimity and you receive enough of what's happening, flowing through life at that moment. So I just thought I would share that. I'm curious for your take on that, and indeed for Tasha's as well. I know we share some same beliefs there, but yeah.
That's beautiful. What hearing you speak makes me think of is one of the things I think that can get lost in conversations around spirituality, ritual, especially in capitalist contexts, right? Like in the marketplace, is that rituals are not decorative, right? They're not just there to be nice, but they are formative. They are supposed to shape us. And so that's what I love about the word practice that you're using, is that it is a practice, right? We are supposed to be shaped by these things to become more intentional, aware, caring, and full of equanimity, right? Like there's a direction to which these traditions and which these practices are taking us. And I think sometimes we don't bring enough of a critical lens to look at, what am I being shaped into by the practices that I have? And that's why I've ended up being really eager that the practices that I have are in some way embedded in relationships, because I cannot trust just my own sense of who I'm becoming. You know, as part of a work project a few years ago, I spent a lot of time trying to think about, is there an instrument that could be designed, some sort of evaluation of our spiritual well-being? And one of the biggest challenges within that kind of inquiry was, it's not just about how you self-evaluate, right? It's about your spouse saying, are you more patient or not?
Exactly.
It's about your colleague saying, are you more generous or not? Right? Like there is a way in which we're acting on the world that the world gets to say if we're becoming more like that or not.
Totally.
And so I think that's what I'm really hooking into with that word practice, is there's a direction to that practice of who we are going to become.
Oh, gosh, I love that. Yeah. We are very in sync. I don't think we've ever had such a long lead up to a practice.
I know.
We
I
so
want to
excited.
Keep talking, but I actually really want to
We
try
will do
out
more
this.
Talking yeah. after the practice, but maybe we should, or the ritual, maybe we should just get an example of one such ritual, of which your book has many. So I encourage everybody to check out Casper's book if you haven't already. So what do we got on the docket here?
Yeah, so I thought, because there's three of us, this is actually perfect. I wanna try out a slightly adapted version of a sacred text practice. And now I was lucky enough to help co-host a podcast for many years called Harry Potter and the Sacred Text, where we applied traditional Jewish and Christian reading practices with a contemporary classic. And you know, because that story has, you know, 20, 25 years after its publication, still has such an active fandom, much more complicated now over the last few years, which we can talk about, as, by the way, every sacred text is complicated. But it is a way into a textual practice that I've just loved. And so what I want to lead us into is we're gonna take just a snippet of the Harry Potter books. And I've taken the first line of the first book. And so if you've never read these books or don't know the story or think this isn't for me, stay with us, because so I wanna essentially take us through a reading of this piece of text, and then we're gonna ask ourselves four different questions. And Lectio Divina comes from was kind of first formalized by a monk many centuries ago called Guijo II, who wrote this idea of going up a ladder, and through each series of questionings, there was different kind of quality of our awareness, a different quality of our meditation on these words. And so we've adapted in the Harry Potter and the Sacred Text podcast, we adapted that framework a little bit for our contemporary time. And so I'm going to post the text here in our little recording chat. And Tasha, maybe you'd be willing to read it the first time round, and then Jeff will ask you to read it again. And then I'm going to ask us a question. And we're each going to just take a moment of quiet for everyone at home listening too. And then the three of us will share what comes up for us. And we'll go through these four questions, these four rungs of the ladder, as we kind of climb up to the divine or you know, go down to the deepest depths of meaning. So it's just one short sentence. And Tasha, if you're ready, I'll invite you just to read it for us the first time around.
Can I just say how excited I am that we have a podcast where we just get to randomly read Harry Potter and then like meditate together, and we're all grown-ups. This is amazing. This is so cool. Okay, let me read. Hold on. I don't think my glasses are strong enough. Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much.
Beautiful. Jeff, will you read it for us one more time?
Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. So Guijo asks us at first just to stay at the surface level of the text. So most of the time we read a text, certainly fiction, we kind of read it for entertainment or as a fan, and we're taking, you know, taken through the plot. And so that's the level at which we're just going to ask this first question. So I want you to just take a moment and ask yourself, what is literally happening in the narrative? Where are we in the story? What's going on? What do you notice? And you can answer that out loud. What are you noticing?
We've got
Who have we met? Where are we?
We've got a maybe middle-aged married couple in the burbs somewhere,
definitely
who are
sounds
very
suburban.
Happy to not be excitable. Nothing crazy is going on in their life, and that's just fine by them.
Yes. I would say we have a voice of conformity coming down the pipeline, and we know exactly where they live. Number 4, Privet Drive.
Absolutely. I love that. Yeah, conformity, and maybe even, you know, the thank you very much is kind of a little passive aggressive.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Definitely.
They're really, really eager for us to know that. So, yeah, we've got Mr. and Mrs. Dudley, a couple. They live in Privet Drive. And, yeah, exactly right. They're kind of very eager for us to know that they are normies. They fit in. There's no strange things happening here. So that's the way we would usually read a novel, right? We'd move on to the next sentence. But with this practice, what we're going to do now is we're going to kind of ascend on one step of this ladder of monks to the divine. And so this time, we're going to ask ourselves a different question, which is, what allegorical images, stories, songs, metaphors, or anything else that kind of your brain notices and connects with on an allegorical level, what else is showing up for you? Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much.
Well, this is going to sound very strange, but when Tasha read it for the first time, I did have this image of these two kind of larger-than-life figures with their arms crossed over their chest, yeah. And they were kind of defending something. There was like a entrance to a cave or something. I'm really just giving you my id here. This is just bubbled up from the subconscious, but that was something I had in mind. I almost imagined them as like guardians to the gates of hell or something.
Yeah, that kind of defensive nature, like don't ask more questions than we want you to. Don't come looking over here. And guardians to a different world. That's really something. I love that.
I think for me, it's similar, but I've been working with the tarot a lot. So the image of the Hierophant came up, which is like tradition, learning the lineage that you're in and not straying and learning the rules for the good of you and all that kind of like semi-religious kind of like straddling the should and should not world.
Right. This real sense of like, this is the way to do it. Don't stray beyond the delineated path. And for me, I always notice the number 4, which is kind of like, right? We use the word square to indicate someone who's really sticking to convention.
Yeah. That's cool.
Right? Like, it's a stable structure. It's kind of, you know, kind of boring. no hate on the number 4.
In numerology, 4 is like the first stability number. It's like the 4 walls, the 4 pillars. It holds very firm. You can rely on it, but it's not going anywhere.
What about Privet Drive? Does that have some allegorical significance for you that you've tapped into?
Private. I mean, I think the word privet definitely has some echoes. There's first of all, the word private sounds really similar, right? So again, that sense of don't come looking in. But also the idea of a privet, like a hedge, again, keeping people out. You know, so there's a lot here, I think, in our subconscious awareness that we're getting from these words. And so what we're doing right now is we're kind of opening our creative mind. We're moving beyond the rational meaning towards something that's a little more irrational and creative. And this is what I love about engaging with text in this way, is that over time, as we practice a Lectio Divina or other reading practices, is that we notice that we are not reading the text, but the text is reading us. Mm-hmm. And so that's how you start to think about any text, is that it's a mirror, and it's a way of investigating our own experience.
Beautiful.
And that's what the third step is going to be as we ask a third question, which is, now that we've opened our minds in this kind of creative way, what experiences in your own life come to mind when you hear this being read? Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much.
It makes me feel like Privet Drive is the neighborhood in which I grew up.
Say more.
Yeah. It feels like I grew up around a lot of people who were perfectly normal, thank you very much, and, you know, trying to navigate my own burgeoning sense of weirdness and artisticness in the midst of that, and being like, wait, are they right or am I right? And like not knowing, you know, because there's a lot of confidence in what Mr. and Mrs. Dursley are saying. They're like, this is how it should be done. There's a should in there, right? So it's kind of heavy-handed. It's not just like, our choice is to be normal. You go do your thing. It's more like there's a lot of judgment. So it hits home.
I love this, Tasha, because this is one of the reasons why I love doing this practice. Because honestly, my where I went with my experience, it's not exactly opposed, but it's kind of like traveling in a different direction, because I'm in my mid-30s now, and I have a lot of friends who are like having kids and they can't afford the city anymore. And so they're moving to the suburbs and they're looking around at their life being like, how did I end up here? This is not what I had planned, but like, this is how it has to be because the school and the blah, 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 my family and blah, blah. And so from the outside, I think they would fit into this picture, even though I know on the inside, that's really not how they conceive of themselves to be. And so I'm suddenly like thinking like, oh my God, how am I judging people, you know, who fit that picture? Oh, wow. Now, listen, they're telling us that they're perfectly normal. Thank you very much.
Yes.
So I'm not discounting what the text is saying, but just in my own experience, like I think a lot of people end up in this situation never wanting to and never really feeling like this is what they're supposed to be. Mm. And it's so healthy that we had different instincts because that's the point of communal reading, right? Because so often our different experiences get revealed through a text like this, which means that the kind of our own supremacy of our own ideas gets whittled away because we have to hear what someone else is saying. So I really
that's so exciting though, because
that.
you sharing that, as soon as you started sharing that, I was like, oh, of course, like that totally rings true for, you know, I have friends who in Toronto, there's this mass exodus to Hamilton right now where it's like slightly more affordable than downtown. But, and so I know same thing. I have a lot of friends who moved out there. They find themselves in, you know, living on Privet Drive and having this normal life. And, but there's almost like inwardly, they don't want to be doing it, but there is still this kind of like, you know, when you make the choice and you just have to own it. So you're like, thank you very much. I'm fine with this. And you're like, are you though? You know? So it's like, as soon as you said that, I can find that in my experience. But what came to me was just like, I don't know, like maybe like a flag of a deeper trauma or something that's, you know, specifically
mine. Totally. No, I'm sorry. Final thing I'll say, Jeff, is that it makes me also think like, when I end up in a situation like moving to the suburbs, how can I make sure that I don't end up reaffirming the very thing that, right? Like if you're growing up as a queer kid or a weird kid or you don't fit in one way or another, that like even when people don't mean to, they're still doing that kind of exclusionary cultural thing that you experience. So I love how they're melding. Sorry, Jeff.
Oh, no. I just really appreciate what you shared there because I had a very combination. I had very similar to what happened with Tasha, which is I felt a lot of anger. Because I was very much excluded from what was normal. I felt very much on the outside, and I actually wanted to be normal. I just wanted normalcy, and I felt like I wasn't allowed to be in there. But when you said that, when your reflection, it kind of just exploded that for me, and I realized, well, wait, what is normal anyway? I want this illusion of what I imagined it would be to be normal or be neurotypical from the inside, but in reality, I don't even know what that is. And that's the kind of the big, you know, insight, the compassion insight that you get through practices. You're so isolated in your own challenges so often and so convinced of your of how they've isolated you and how they're, you know, the biggest thing. And when you hear about other people's challenges or you hear about other perspectives, it kind of takes you outside of that. And then that just the act of not feeling alone can make all the difference, make the challenge itself so much more bearable. So that was all that just happened when you two shared your thing. So.
Oh, I love that.
That's so cool.
There's something to this practice.
Yeah.
There's something to it. You know, and just to kind of dial that up is when you engage with text study that people have studied, you know, for generations, it's not just the three of us in conversation around a text. Suddenly you're thinking like, well, what did so-and-so say in the 14th century? And what about, you know, that person when the text was discovered themselves?
And the scholars.
You're entering a stream of conversation that is often centuries or millennia long. You know, the Jewish tradition is built literally around those conversations that rabbis have with each other, disagreeing and discussing and trying to get deeper into the part of it. And what I love about traditions that take that disagreement and discussion seriously is that there's always room for new interpretations because of new experiences. Mm-hmm. So Laura Geller, who was the third rabbi ordained as a woman in the United States in the Reform Movement, was sitting in a class where she was being taught, you know, various different blessings at, you know, the different moments of life and different experiences. The first time you see particular blossoms in the spring or when you see the ocean. And she was like, hundreds of these blessings, nothing for when you first get your period. And it was because, like, you know, there haven't been that many women rabbis before. And so maybe this is a part of life that was overlooked. And so that for me is like a living tradition is when we allow for new experiences and new contexts to enrich the tradition. And so when we do text study, you know, it's never to say that the ancient, you know, usually dude, was right in his interpretation. But like engaging that interpretation as we share our own makes ours and the traditions better. And so I think that's what we're doing, is we're having these conversations.
That is so, so perfect. Because I think there's this thing that happens where in rejecting, you know, the patriarchy or the way things have been done in normalcy, we kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, like we don't look at ancient texts anymore, or we don't look at niche texts or spiritual texts or whatever. People just are like, not for me, right? But there's so much there, even if it's just like what we just did, to read it.
Yeah.
And as a mirror for ourselves, what comes up when I read the sentence? Why do I get mad? You know, like, what's there?
You know?
But we're always kind of looking for the next new published book. And it's like billions of words have been written that we can look to, you know?
So the final, I love this because you're taking us really to the final question, which is, you know, having read it narratively, allegorically, and then experientially, what is now the action that you feel called to take because of the way you've engaged with this text? Is there something you want to activate or do based on this? So I'll read it one more time. We'll just take a moment. Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much.
Makes you want to make friends with a normal person. It makes you want to reach out and be like,
what are they like?
I have no idea. No idea.
Just feed them something and see what they do.
Yeah, I want to like give them like, I don't know, sushi or something and have them be like. Exactly.
You're hilarious.
I just want to find a normal, and then let's make friends, and then let's bridge that gap. Like, so they know a weirdo and I know a normal, and we're both happy. Thank you very much.
Nice.
I love that.
How about you, Jeff?
Well, actually, you know, it's very interesting. It's pointing me to something that I have been going over and over. I kind of feel like this is moving me towards my main work that I kind of have to offer out in the world. I haven't quite found a term for it. I am very interested in neurodiversity, and I have ADHD. I have a bipolar diagnosis, and I know a lot of people in that who are kinds of these extremes of these continuums of attention, of sensitivity, of emotionality, of sociability, whatever you want to call it. And that term is a particular term of empowerment, you know, emerged from the autism community. And so I want to let it stay as that term of empowerment, because it's important that that those folks who have felt on the margins are honored in some way. And at the same time, the reality is we're all diverse. And this is true just sort of cognitively, spiritually, emotionally. We have a kind of fingerprint nervous system that is unique and spread across these different spectrums. And I've been looking for a word that captures that. And it can't be neurodiversity for the reasons I just described, because I want to keep that for the folks who really identify with that or have found it helpful. So what is that word? And so this is what that brought me to. And I think it's like, I know I want to just keep, this is what I'm, first of all, I want to hear from you too. What should that word be? But this reading makes me think, this is what this is about. This is about showing that there is no normal. That normal is like, normal doesn't exist. It's a statistical mean, you know, that isn't actually refer to anything real. What's a word we can use to make everyone feel empowered to explore and understand their own diversity in that sense? And I don't know what that word is, but that's whatever that word is what that was pointing me to, that reading.
That's beautiful. I love this. The action I'm kind of reflecting on is I went for a walk this weekend through a neighborhood in Brooklyn, and like I even texted my husband. I was a little mean, but like there was this group of young women, and they were trying so hard to be normal, right? Like they were trying so hard to like fit into the trend and like wear the right clothes. And I was like, hashtag girlies, you know, walking the streets of Brooklyn. And what it makes me think of, Jeff, is really related to what you're saying, which is like how hard work it is to try and be normal. Jesus. But like, there is no normal. Like there is, it's this imaginary medium that actually no one is. Mm-hmm. You know, even from like, the seats on a plane are built around one particular body standard, which no one has that exact body.
I've never met somebody who wasn't completely uncomfortable in an airplane.
Exactly. And like, what a metaphor for life, right? Like the expectations we carry around gender, around like how, you know, all of the different pieces. So I want to be, my action that I want to take is be compassionate in remembering when I see someone try really hard to be normal and be like, that must be exhausting because I know it has been for me. So, so this is a little sacred reading practice that, you know, pick up and run, and you can do it with any piece of text. Honestly, I think as long as you think the text is generative, so that it's gonna lead you to conversations that are meaningful, then you can work with a practice like this at home.
Yeah, it made me think that it's very similar to how I engage with the I Ching, or how I engage with astrology, or maybe how you engage with tarot, Tasha. That in a sense that if you just put aside for a moment, you know, any objective claims about those things, although I think that there is a place for that too, just the way they hold up mirrors to who we are. Mm-hmm. It's a set of messages or framings or metaphors that they're a mirror, and that we can look back and say, oh, this is how this does or doesn't fit into my life. And I think that's, it's very useful to underline that. And the fact is, anything can be a sacred text with that kind of intention in mind. In fact, your life can be a sacred text. You could say that that's what it means to live in a truly mystical perspective. Mm-hmm. Is everything is meaningful because everything is reflecting back some organizing principle about life or your life, or and in that mm-hmm. sense, you know, then you're living in a truly generative world.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. We've had a very high octane, excitable this conversation
was so much
with you.
Fun.
Yes, but we got to do another one. Did we? How are we for timing? Do we have? Okay,
we have some time. I like, honestly, I don't think I'm ever going to read anything the same ever again. Like I read a ton, and I usually do. Like I'm a really reflective kind of reader, and I'm like reading in the storyline, and then I'm also reading in terms of like trying to understand what the author was doing, and then also there's that little part of me that always thinks I'm better than the author, and I'm like, they got this wrong, or you know what I mean? Like, but there's this whole new element here of like, it's almost a challenge to like find the most mundane Passover kind of sentence in the book that you're reading and really have it mean something to you. Like, I love it. It's really cool.
A good challenge. And we have definitely, you know, we've done hundreds of these practices now through the, you know, the seven books of the Harry Potter series, and my co-host actually is redoing all seven books now. Wow. Because what do you do when you finish a sacred text? You start back at the beginning, right? Yeah. But what I really love is shifting that idea of what counts as a sacred text, because so often we think about sacredness as something that's assigned to the text from on high. And, you know, for some people's theological worldview, that is true. That's not my experience. The way I like to think about it is that we make something sacred by returning to it again and again. Yeah. And so when a community engages a text with the biggest questions that you can ask around life and suffering and love and joy, you know, that's what makes a text sacred. And the sacredness comes from the doing, right? It's yeah. not assigned at birth as somehow superior. It's a human-made collection of words. But it is the care and the love and the attention that's been brought to it generation after generation that makes it valuable.
And
so I love that you're doing that too. And we've now joined a little stream of people doing that with this with this Harry Potter book.
Yeah, well, so much of it also seems to be the thing that you do inside to really receive it. You know, there's a kind of slowness around like not just overriding it with your agenda, with your hurried next thing. It's can I actually pause? And so much that has to do with creating the space for that to happen. You say, yeah. This is going to be a sacred practice. Oh, okay. Now everyone slows down. Now there's a quality of presence or yeah. that we're bringing to it. And that's the value of a community, because, you know, this is what people I hear again and again as a meditation teacher. People have great experiences sitting on with themselves, alone in themselves. And that's fine. That's for a lot of people to do the practice. But for a lot of people coming and doing it in community, it gives a kind of legitimacy to what you're doing and highlights qualities in your experience that you may find hard to find in other contexts. So,
yeah, just zooming out, Jeff, I think you're so right that, and this is what I really feel called to do at this point in my work is we are saturated with great content. I mean, and we're both guilty of making it, right? Like there is so much great stuff out there, books, podcasts, retreats, all sorts of amazing things. And so what I'm really interested in creating at this point are, what are the containers for connection,
yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. What are the set aside times and spaces yeah. where people come together to do something like this? And so, you know, that's been a big motivation for the Nearness, which I mentioned off air, as you know, basically an invitation to be part of a small group, to each week come back for a conversation like this that is structured, that opens with a breath and body awareness practice, that spends some time cultivating the community covenant, right? The way we agree in which we're going to be together over this 90 minutes, that engages in a deep reflection and then an intentional way of sharing our reflections with each other, and closes with, you know, a short blessing to help us back into the world. But it's so rare to have that time and space set aside. And I think it's particularly difficult to be in it and make it at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's such a gift when someone else is holding that or designing that invitation. So you can just step into it and be in it. So I love that you're pointing us to that power of structure.
Yeah. So can you just say a little bit more that this is a program that you offer, that people find out about it through your website? It's called The Nearness. One example of many of communities of practice that are popping up in different places. Love you to say a little bit more about it. So if people are interested, they can join the stream there.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's beautiful to see a whole crop of these experiences popping up at the moment. So The Nearness is a tool to connect deeply with yourself and others through rich conversation. And the setup is that you sign up for a 10-week journey. You meet each week for 90 minutes with a small group on Zoom, and you follow a really beautifully curated set of reflection exercises, sometimes an embodied practice, sometimes journaling practice or a creative writing or all sorts of different modalities to get you into your reflection heart, body, brain. And the theme for this journey that we've got signups open for until February 2nd is, how do I connect more deeply with nature? So we'll be exploring all sorts of different ways of connecting with the natural world, remembering that we are already part of it, not separate from it. So drawing from different wisdom traditions, different practices as a way of connecting more deeply with nature. And my favorite thing is seeing how, you know, you sign up as an individual, you get matched into this small group of strangers, but the safety of strangers means that you actually get to go deeper than you do in some conversations with people in your everyday life. So if you're interested, we've got scholarships available. We're really eager for anyone who wants to participate to be part of it. So head on to thenearness.coop and sign up if you're interested.
Awesome. And we'll include that link in our newsletter and everything for the episode.
And Casper has a website. We'll include that. Mention your book, The Power of Ritual. Any new books coming? And the podcast, The Harry Potter God Podcast.
What's it called?
It's called Harry Potter and the Sacred Text.
Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. I'm listening to that.
Oh, I so appreciate being with you. Thanks for having me. And thanks for doing this beautiful work. It's really wonderful.
This was a lot of fun.
You're welcome. Great to have you on.
And now, join us for the after party at mindbodpod.com, where me and Jeff talk candidly about whatever didn't get said in this week's episode, and chat in the comments with the whole MindBod squad. Don't forget to subscribe for new episodes every week, and if you want to support our crazy adventures, consider becoming a paid subscriber on Substack at mindbodpod.com. See you there!